available on digital media, iTunes podcast, smartphone apps, and from the online website. This is Outlook, the talking newspaper for Coventry.
Hello from me, Nigel Hewin, and welcome to this week's edition of Outlook, being recorded on Wednesday the 8th of October 2025. Now, just before we start, I've got to make an apology. This programme is going to be slightly shorter than normally, because this is all really in my court. I live out at Langley, and for the last 3 weeks our internet has been less than intermittent. It's been sort of occasionally one day with now and other days not. So for the last couple of weeks we managed to cope with that. But this week, for the preparing this programme, has created a little bit of a problem, so we are a little bit short. Not a lot, probably about a quarter of an hour shorter at the worst. So we've made up for a bit of that by having slightly longer news as well. So what is in this programme? Well, firstly, we're going to go to Newbold on Stour with Elaine. We're then going to find out a bit about how the pyramids were constructed. And we can move on to a man called Henry Blogg, who had an exceptional career in the RNLI, i.e. Saving Lives. And then there's something from Pete. He has written an article saying disaster at 4,500 feet. And I will leave you to work out which 4,500. Is it upwards in the air? Is it up a mountain? Is it in deep sea? We shall find out later. And we're going to end this week's programme with a very short bit of poetry by Roald Dahl. But of course we have got the usual things of your postbag, sport and news from the hub with I presume will be Hugh this week. I haven't seen him, but I presume it will be. But in the meantime, coverage of the local news with Elaine and Peter.
Outlook News.
An inspirational politician who was instrumental in securing peace in Northern Ireland has been honoured with a commemorative plaque at her old school in Coventry, 20 years after her death. A blue plaque to commemorate the late Mo Molum has been unveiled by the Coventry Society. Journalist Julia Langdon, who wrote a biography of Mo Molum in 2000, unveiled the plaque at Clowndon Court School, where the former minister was a pupil from 1962 to 1968. As Secretary of State for Northern Ireland in Tony Blair's government, Mo Molum was credited with breaking the stalemate between Republicans and Unionists, notably by going into the Mays prison and talking to senior paramilitaries from both sides, culminating in the signing of the historic Good Friday Agreement in 1998. The blue plaque was commissioned by the Coventry Society and installed in partnership with the school, led by head teacher Chris Heal. Among the speakers at the unveiling was Sue Cooper, a former classmate of Mo Molum's at the school, which at the time was a single-sex girls' comprehensive school. Three current pupils at the school also took part in the ceremony. Peter Walters from the Coventry Society said, "Mo's example showed just what can be achieved with determination, force of personality and emotional intelligence. It feels appropriate to have installed the plaque at the school where current and future Clowndon Court School pupils can see it and perhaps take some inspiration from it."
Roads around schools in Coventry are set to get safer following the announcement that Coventry's School Streets programme is set to grow. The scheme, which aims to make children's journeys to and from school safer by reducing traffic and congestion, will make permanent four trial areas in roads around Ravensdale, Southfields, Stanton Bridge and Cardinal Wiseman schools, which were launched a year ago. It will now be expanded to cover Holbrook Primary School, that's Gateside Road and Crown Green, Limbrick Wood Primary School, Bush Close, and Aldermore Farm Primary School, Pinley Fields. The scheme aims to create a calmer, safer journey for children and families and a more welcoming environment for walking, cycling and wheeling. As with the existing school streets, the new zones will feature camera-based monitoring and updated traffic regulation orders. The new zones should be introduced next April, with consultations set to begin very soon and final plans expected by the end of this year. They will be funded by Coventry City Council's Active Travel Fund. Councillor Patricia Heatherton, the Cabinet Member for City Services, said, "Our School Streets initiative is making a real difference to families across Coventry. We've seen safer, healthier school environments thanks to fewer cars and more children walking, cycling or wheeling. With Phase 2 sites now set to become permanent and Phase 3 on the way, we're committed to doing all we can to create safer, calmer streets for all. The School Streets programme is a key part of the Council's wider efforts to promote active travel, improve air quality and create more livable neighbourhoods. Residents are encouraged to get involved in future consultations and help shape the next phase of this growing initiative."
Residents of a Coventry neighbourhood have taken part in a project that used virtual reality to showcase the benefits of energy-efficient homes. The project, led by the University of Warwick, is aimed at helping the 20% of city households impacted by fuel poverty. People in Ball Hill experienced the benefits of retrofitting their homes, which included upgrading boilers, installing solar panels, and improving insulation. The university said the project is breaking down barriers to make the process more relatable and accessible through immersive virtual reality workshops. The event is a partnership between the university, Coventry City Council, Act on Energy and community hub Destination Ball Hill, and forms part of a wider Retrofit Rocks initiative, which aims to raise awareness of measures in place. At the workshop, residents were walked through a 3D model of a retrofitted home, witnessed the improvements, and took away an understanding of the real-world benefits for greater comfort, better health, and lower energy bills. Dr. Laurie Burrell, Associate Professor at the University of Warwick, said the immersive aspect to the project stops the benefits being abstract. She said, "Virtual reality makes retrofit feel real and achievable, helping Coventry families cut bills, improve comfort and health, and lower emissions. Pairing trusted advice with immersive experience, we hope to turn awareness."
This is like the cricket one, isn't it?
"We hope to turn awareness into action so that no one has to choose between heating and eating." The university said the workshop responds directly to the city's need to boost uptake of energy-saving measures. It said that despite funding schemes, uptake remains low, often due to lack of awareness or confidence in the process. Jim O'Boyle, Coventry City Council's Cabinet Member for Jobs, Regeneration and Climate Change, said, "As we head into the colder months and face rising energy prices, it's important that we find ways to show Coventry residents what retrofit looks and feels like. This innovative VR project brings that to life, making it more real for people and easier to see and understand the benefits."
Well, that's one way to make the programme last a little longer, isn't it, Elaine? Coventry Cathedral will be hosting a civic service and vigil on Friday, November the 14th, to commemorate the 85th anniversary of the Coventry Blitz. This year's theme for the event is Remembering Well to Move Forward. The service will start at 5:30 p.m. and will be led by the Dean of Coventry, the Very Reverend John Whitcomb. It will also include contributions from faith leaders, city schools, choral pieces and guests from Germany via video link for the national gathering of the Community of the Cross of Nails in Munster, Germany. Attendees will move to the cathedral ruins as two sirens sound at 6:55 p.m. to mark the exact time of the 1940 air raid, followed by a 2-minute silence for people to pay their respects. Deputy Leader and Cabinet Member for Coventry City Council, Councillor Abdul Salam Khan, said, "The 85th anniversary of the Coventry Blitz is a major date in the city's history and event calendar, and we are proud to be jointly hosting a civic event with the Cathedral, timed specifically to coincide with the 14th of November. We would welcome people to join us in being part of a moving and poignant service to mark the anniversary and vigil alongside civic guests and faith leaders in our community. This period in our history also demonstrated how, as a city, an amazing sense of community spirit and resilience emerged, and this remains true today, along with a strong sense of civic pride. Coventry will always remember and continue to work for a better future. Canon for Arts and Reconciliation at Coventry Cathedral, Reverend Kate Massey, added, "On this anniversary, we pass on the baton from the generation who made that first decision for peace to a new generation of Coventrians. As we remember, we allow our city's story to inspire us to continue the work of reconciliation in a world that needs healing and hope." Members of the public are welcome to attend the service and vigil, both of which are free but ticketed events. People can purchase their free tickets via the Coventry Cathedral website.
Coventry Cathedral is marking the 25th anniversary of its Millennium Chapel by honouring locals who have made lasting impressions on the city. The cathedral will etch the names of children or adults on the glass screen to celebrate their contributions to Coventry as part of a fundraising endeavour. The chapel, a room previously used for flower arrangements, was rededicated in 2000 as an area for quiet reflection to commemorate the turn of the millennium. The Reverend Nitano Muller said the cathedral was looking for the names of ordinary men, women and children who have touched lives in a personal capacity. The chapel is a really special place. It's been used as a reflective space for people to have a think and pray, with the names of loved ones, benefactors added to the beautiful transparent screen. We're calling on people to forward names to us as part of a new fundraising endeavour, so those people can be remembered for the legacies that they've left behind. Mr. Muller said he had spoken to the family of Keaton Slater, the 12-year-old boy killed in a car crash last year, about adding his name to the screen. He said, "Keaton is close to our hearts and has left a lasting impression on us, as well as his family and all that they've done for the city since his passing." While celebrity names are also on the list, the cathedral has a space for everyone. It is part of a bigger conversation to raise money for the cathedral. We will also be inviting donations to support the inclusion of these names and to help care for this special chapel for future generations.
On Monday of this week, a historic and much-loved Coventry Youth Club was named as one of the runners-up in the Outstanding Community Project in the Police and Crime Commissioner's Outstanding Citizens Awards 2025. The awards ceremony at a packed Brass House community centre in Smethwick saw the region come together to honour extraordinary individuals and community groups who go above and beyond to make a difference. The Coventry Boys and Girls Club's MAC project has been winning admirers thanks to its efforts working with 10 to 19 year olds, offering crime diversion and prevention programs, as well as reparation and community service opportunities. Launched in 2020, the MAC project delivers holistic, tailored programs designed to help young people overcome complex challenges, including mental health struggles, peer pressure, inequality, family breakdown, and youth violence. Since its launch, the project has received 299 referrals from schools, probation and youth offending services for one-to-one mentoring sessions. In the past 12 months alone, it has received 80 referrals, working with 11 schools across the city. In addition to one-to-one mentoring, the MAC project has also been commissioned by West Midlands Police to deliver targeted group sessions in schools facing concerns about external influences affecting their pupils. A spokesman for the club said, "We are honoured to be recognised in the PCC Awards for the mentoring work we deliver through the MAC project across Coventry. This project is a targeted early intervention program designed to help young people reach their full potential. At its core, it offers consistent, tailored mentoring support to those who need it most, both in and out of school settings. This recognition motivates us to keep expanding the project, reaching more young people, and continuing to be a trusted and empowering presence in the community.
Youth workers in Coventry have been praised for their dedication after 130 children and young people were referred to mentoring programmes. Workers spent the six-week school summer holidays meeting young people and de-escalating conflicts in parks, city centres and violence hotspots in the city. Teams from Sky Blues in the Community, Guiding Young Minds, Empower You, Guardian Ballers and Coventry Boys and Girls Club clocked up 1,000 hours in total. West Midlands Police and Crime Commissioner Simon Foster said the workers were vital to the city's commitment to tackling youth violence. The £35,000 summer initiative was funded by the West Midlands Violence Reduction Programme and led by Coventry City Council as part of its campaign for a child-friendly Coventry. Ash McBride, senior community coach at Sky Blues in the Community, said being out in the community every day gave them the chance to connect with young people on their terms. He said they use sports and games to break the ice in parks to start conversations with young people. It was about building trust, creating safe spaces and just being present. Talking, listening, showing we cared. Young people said they felt listened to, more seen, and you could see them grow in confidence. Their energy, honesty and resilience showed us why this work matters. Mr. Foster said the importance of such youth work is often overlooked and needs more recognition. It would be impossible without the dedication of those youth workers on the ground who know their communities and the challenges that their young people face. Coventry's Community Safety Partnership does a brilliant job of bringing those teams together and working with them and the police to ensure they are operating in areas where they can have maximum impact. This is something which the Violence Reduction Partnership replicates across the West Midlands, with £35,000 going to each local authority area for detached youth work every year.
When Mushtaq Dawood and Safwan Ahmed were growing up in Coventry, their local youth clubs were a lifeline. After school sessions, football tournaments and boxing classes at Positive Youth Foundation gave them a safe space, a sense of belonging and, perhaps without them realising it at the time, the blueprint for something much bigger. Today, the pair are at the heart of Creed, their own community interest company. The Friends set up the organisation to bring that same energy back to the neighbourhoods they grew up in. Areas where youth clubs have vanished, parks lie empty, and young people are too often left with nowhere to go. Creed aims to educate young people of Coventry on the benefits of boxing and fitness training. With a focus on confidence building, fostering friendships, instilling self-discipline and enhancing overall physical and mental well-being, Creed creates a safe and supportive environment where young people can learn and grow while staying active. Both men first came across PYF, the Positive Youth Foundation, when they were teenagers. Saf remembers football tournaments and summer camps where staff felt like mini parents. Mush recalls boxing sessions and youth clubs that kept him off the streets. But over time, they saw those spaces disappear. Saf says, that youth club I used to go to has turned into a nursery. The park we spend every weekend at just became an empty field. So when Mush suggested setting up something new, something local, the decision was easy. We said, let's keep it in our park, let's rebuild it where we grew up, Mush explains. Now, PYF supports more than 3,000 young people each year across five strands of work, from education and training to health, mentoring and sport. Mush describes it as a good old-fashioned youth club, the only one that also tackles some of modern society's biggest challenges, like inequality and exploitation. For both men, that ethos was the launch pad for Creed. In just a couple of years, it has created a community of its own. Saf describes how children who barely spoke in their first sessions are now laughing, making friends, and finding confidence. You can see them come out of their shell. That's the reward, he said. One pleasant surprise has been the large number of girls taking part. Nearly 40% of our groups are female, Mush notes. That's huge, because in our community especially, sport was always seen as for the boys. But now you've got girls boxing, playing football, and believing they can do just as much as the boys. The sessions do not just give young people a safe outlet. They give Mush and Saf something back too. Our days are hectic, but those 2 hours with the kids brings us back to life. They remind us of our own childhood, says Saf. The long-term vision is to keep growing, from outdoor park sessions to, eventually, a dedicated community space. But for now, it's about steady progress. If we can be 1% better than last year, that's success, Mush states. They believe their journey shows the true value of youth work, its ripple effect. For the two men, it's simple. We had people who believed in us when we were kids. Now it's our turn to do the same.
A Coventry landmark has been named among the top 10% experiences globally by TripAdvisor, ranked alongside the Eiffel Tower and Colosseum. St Mary's Guildhall, a Grade 1 listed building on Bailey Lane, has received the TripAdvisor Traveller's Choice Award for the third year in a row, thanks to its consistently positive reviews. The 14th century building in the city's Cathedral Quarter reopened in 2022 after a two-year restoration project costing $5 million and has since welcomed thousands more visitors. Built in 1342, the building has been used as an English Civil War armoury and a Victorian soup kitchen, and has welcomed the likes of Mary, Queen of Scots, and other royals. The 700-year-old building is open year-round for heritage visits, private tours, dining, and events. It also hosts exhibitions and other activities. St Mary's is also known for the Coventry Tapestry, which is believed to be among the oldest in Britain. Abby Moore, Heritage and Venue Manager at St Mary's, said retaining the accolade was a testament to the team who work hard to make it an inspiring visitor attraction. Ms Moore said, "It's a privilege to see so many people engaging with the remarkable stories contained within these walls, from medieval merchants to royal visitors. We're so proud to be part of Coventry's cultural landscape, and to receive this recognition from our visitors is incredibly special."
A Coventry man who has been donating blood for more than half a century is encouraging others to join him. Peter Randall, aged 69, started giving blood as an 18-year-old student. He has O negative blood, a universal group meaning that any patient can have it in an emergency, and he has donated 138 times. Peter, who is helping NHS Blood and Transplant raise awareness, said, "I realised that it was more important for me to give blood, which is what motivated me to keep giving. It's just something you can do to help society, so I would encourage everyone to do it." Mr. Randall has a condition called hemochromatosis, meaning his blood produces too much iron, which can attach itself to organs if not controlled. Taking blood is actually a treatment for this condition, so Mr. Randall is allowed to donate every 2 months rather than the usual three. "It's a win-win, because I can give more often and more people will benefit from it. So I put my foot on the accelerator then, and now go about every week, about every 8 weeks," he said. NHSBT has thanked blood, organ and stem cell donors as it celebrates its 20th anniversary. It was established in October 2005 when the National Blood Authority, UK Transport and Bioproducts Laboratory merged to create one organisation. Since that began, Mr. Randall has donated blood 88 times, the highest number in the 20-year history. A further 41 donors have donated more than 80 times. Dr. Gail Mifflin, Chief Medical Officer at NHSBT, said it could not have carried out its life-saving work without the millions of generous blood, organ, plasma, platelet and stem cell donors who have put themselves forward to help those who need it. We cannot thank them enough for everything they've done and continue to do.
Animals who would ordinarily fall through the cracks are being supported by a recently launched vet clinic in Coventry, opened by the RSPCA Coventry and District Branch in Horsley. The clinic aims to address the growing number of unvaccinated and unneutered cats and dogs in the West Midlands. Consultations have reduced by 5% over the last 3 years, and fewer animals are being vaccinated. Charities across the region are rescuing, rehabilitating and rehoming more dogs and cats every year, with the RSPCA Coventry seeing an 11% increase in the intake of abandoned cats between 2019 and 2025. RSPCA staff say it is driven by factors including the rising cost of living, mandatory microchipping, increased vet fees, a lack of neutering and the lingering impacts of COVID. Increasing neutering rates is a key part of the strategy to reduce the number of unwanted litters and, ultimately, the number of animals being abandoned. Bosses are also working closely with the range of city-based organisations, including Coventry Cats Protection, Coventry Cat Group and Hisses to Hope. Coventry Cats Protection, a long-standing partner of RSPCA Coventry, was the first charity to bring animals to the new facility. Wendy Harris from the Cats Protection said, "It gives us a much-needed resource to neuter our cats and reduce the travel time and stress on our animals. Knowing we are working in partnership with a reputable local animal charity with shared aims to rescue and rehome makes our work easier." Cat owners are being encouraged to access services such as neutering and microchipping at the new city-based facility, with no registration fee needed. It is open from Monday to Thursday at the RSPCA Centre. Manager Lorraine Bryan said, "We know there are people and animals falling through the cracks. Those who do not qualify for support from charities like the PDSA, but still cannot afford vet fees. And this service is designed to help them and their pets stay happy and healthy." Veterinary nurse Michaela Hatton added, "Our aim is to fill a vital gap for those affected by rising costs. It is for cats and dogs who otherwise might not receive vaccinations to keep them healthy. Appointments can be booked by emailing the RSPCA or by calling on 024 7633 6616.
Acclaimed street artist David Speed spent 60 hours creating a mural for the University of Warwick's 60th anniversary. His mural of a 3-metre-high neon goose, named Temporary Home, was painted in honour of the university's most recognisable campus residents, the grey lag geese. Students arriving for Welcome Week were able to watch the animal be immortalised on the exterior of the Piazza building in bold colours. Mr. Speed said that the mural was a collaboration between him and the students, adding, "I wanted the people to have ownership of it and to use their ideas." London-based Mr. Speed, known for his signature neon pink artworks, started painting the mural on Tuesday and completed the work on Thursday last week. He returned to bring the mural to life after spending 60 hours on campus in the spring to spend time with students to find out what the university meant to them. He said, "I asked, what are your thoughts and feelings and what do you want to celebrate on the walls?" The university said that the geese artwork brought together two campus icons, its much-loved geese and the dramatic staircase of the Faculty of Arts building. Mr. Speed said, "I was training to be a teacher before I decided to become an artist, so it was really lovely after 15 years or so to be back working with young people again. I didn't just want to come in and create a piece of street art. I had sessions with students. There was a lot of brainstorming." Professor Jonathan Neelands, Professor of Creative Education, said the mural highlighted energy and moments of connection to the campus. The campus is also a temporary home for many of us, he said, a place of welcome, togetherness and collaboration. David's pioneering artistry will spark other cultural innovations across the campus. Mr. Speed added, most people who visited the campus will fly away someday, but it's my hope that this mural becomes a landmark and a memory from their time here, in their temporary home and the Geese's permanent one.
A new map reveals what could be a huge new addition to Coventry's War Memorial Park. Proposals have emerged for a new paddle court at the city's premier park. The popularity of the sport paddle has rocketed, with new courts appearing across the country, and now the War Memorial Park looks set to be the latest to play home to one. Coventry City Council papers detail the proposals for a court within the park, and a map shows it is likely to be based close to the tennis courts. It is being proposed the Council's Shareholders Committee, acting in capacity of charitable trustees, approves the Council going to market to him. This would be a legal arrangement with a minimum 15-year lease between the successful operator and Coventry City Council. Under this option, the construction and operational costs would sit with the operator and they would pay an agreed rental plus a negotiated profit share. The paper goes on to explain, officer time will be allocated towards the lease of the land acting on behalf of the charity. The positive impact will be the improved offer for residents and visitors to the park. It is likely that increased visitor footfall from paddle will support more interest in other activities in the park, including commercial interests at the site, such as the hospitality concessions, which in turn support the financial position of the park. It adds that the Council's Park Services will monitor and manage the ongoing management of the contract. Members of the Coventry Shareholders Committee were meeting this Tuesday, October the 7th, to make a final decision on the paddle court plan.
And finally, a black swan has been removed from a historic town after it spent 9 months terrorising other birds and tourists. The bird, named Reggie by locals, was captured by swan warden Cyril Bennis in Stratford-upon-Avon and will be rehomed at a centre in Devon. Mr. Bennis said the capture was what had to be done after the bird's behaviour, which included disrupting nesting swans and attempting to drown the native mute swans. A town resident added, Reggie's terrorised everyone else, but we love him, so it'll be sad to see him go, but it's probably best for the river that he's gone. Reggie has been taken to the vets and will be rehomed at the Dawlish Waterfowl Centre in Devon. It's the best thing for him, said Mr. Bennis. Reggie will have so many mates there, he'll be saying, why in heaven's name did I spend 9 months in Stratford? But its people and its visitors will be very sad.
Outlook News.
My thanks to Elaine and Peter for the news there. And I'm not quite sure what tickled Elaine's fancy, but it's certainly something. And I made a comment, you may have heard half part of it. It reminded me of the very famous one of Brian Johnson and Jonathan Eggers. Jonathan Agnew, I should say, the co-commentators of cricket matches when Brian Johnson completely had a fit of the giggles for, I don't know, it must have been 2 or 3 minutes. It was phenomenal. It's on YouTube, and if anyone hasn't heard it, they really must. It really is a highlight of anyone's cricketing career, I think that, wasn't it? Yep. However, enough of frivolity. The only one I've got is Sunrise and Sunset. Sunrise now is at 7:15 in the morning, and Sunset is 6:20 in the evening. So now we move to Hugh, and welcome.
Thank you very much. Yes, I disapprove of frivolity on principle.
No. We like to prove the human.
Yes, exactly. So we've got the theatre trip coming up a week on Friday. That's now closed, so if you haven't bought your ticket or reserved your ticket, you can't have one because the bus is full. I've been talking to the theatre group today, so we're going to see The Tales of the Cursed House at Aldsley Village Hall. It's outside our usual Criterion trips, so it's the Saints Drama Group who are also raising money for us over the course of their show. They're doing a raffle and collections for each night. So our group, we've got 16, and we're going to I was wondering about Fish and Chip Shopper, whether we'd have time to do that. We will have time to do that if you get here for about 5 o'clock. So 5:15. So I will take orders for fish and chips. We'll be contacting you or seeing you over the course of the week to get your fish and chip orders. But certainly on Friday the 17th, I'll be doing fish and chips, so you can sort that out with reception, either Carol or Heather. Well, actually, Heather's away on holiday because her son's getting married. Heather or Vicky or whoever's there. You can call us as well on 024-7671-7522. Talking of trips out, many of you may have heard of Chris McCausland. Now, Chris McCausland is a blind comedian from Liverpool, but he was also the winner of Strictly Come Dancing last year. Very entertaining man. And he is doing a national tour at the moment of his comedy laughs and what have you. So we are, and he's coming to Warwick Arts Centre at the university, in November, that one's booked out, but also in February. And we were thinking, well, wouldn't it be nice to do a trip from here to go and see Chris McCausland? So, if you don't know what Chris McCausland sounds like, here is a little clip of him.
And my daughter said to me, during the lockdown it was, she said to me that she was sad because she didn't have a little brother or a sister to play with. She actually said to me that she felt sad because she was lonely because she didn't have a little brother or a sister to play with. I mean, what do you do with that as a parent? How do you take the weight of that sadness from a child and hold them and tell them that it's all their fault?
He's great. We are doing, so the tickets, they cost £38. And the show is on Wednesday the 4th of February, 2026. £38. So if you're interested in that, I'm only giving you 1 week to reply. So we will close this down on Thursday, Friday next week. So there will be, so if you haven't put your name forward by then, because that's when I'm going to be booking tickets.
So at the end of next week.
The end of next week, essentially. Yep. Yeah. Then, because the tickets are sell fast and, you know, I can't be guaranteed even at this stage that we'll have enough. Mm-hmm. But anyway, £38 they are. So it'll be £38 plus usual bus stuff as well. It's at 8 o'clock. It's a couple of hours long. So it's a, you know, good late night on a Wednesday. But there we are. So that sounds like it could be a lot of fun. And something, again, a little bit out of the ordinary. And you can be guaranteed there aren't going to be that many visual gags. So it's absolutely...
He's extraordinary, both, actually, isn't he?
Yes, yeah, he's really, really good. Absolutely right down the line for us. By the time you'll have heard this, we'll have been having our open day, which I hope will have gone off with a great deal of success. I've been mentioning the last couple of weeks this issue about the closure of the local eye service at opticians. We're just about today to put out the press release. Today is Wednesday, you're going to put out the press release. Just hopefully that will be picked up by the TV and the radio locally, because it is a serious serious issue. So if you get this on Thursday or maybe even Friday, you just listen out and you may hear. I'm hoping that they will call and let me be on the TV a bit or the radio or whatever. So just keep your ears out for that. It's an important story, and anything you can do to support the issue to try and get the Integrated Care Board to retain community eye services for the next 5 months until April, until they can recommission, would be a good thing. Now, I've had an email from Coventry City Council, and who are developing a new strategy for physical activity. So this means helping more people to move, play sport and enjoy being active. We want everybody in Coventry, they say, to have the chance to be healthier. We agree. This is why here at the Vision Hub we have increased by a huge amount the exercise activities that are available. So their strategy is to help more adults, children and young people to get active, especially in areas where fewer people currently do, to bring together local groups, clubs and people who can support you to be active and close the gap in health between the most and least advantaged communities in Coventry. And according to Coventry, actually visually impaired people are a community and they're amongst the least advantaged. So actually, because of us, the community is actually doing reasonably well for exercise opportunities, but even so for visually impaired people. But they want your help. They want to know how much physical activity you do now. Now, even if you don't take part in our physical activities, I think it'd be really good if you want to take part in this survey to get in contact with them and let them know, even if you don't, and if you'd like to do more as well, that would be useful, because they may come up with some other stuff. So the council wants to know how much physical activity you do now, what makes it difficult for you to be active, and what would help you to move more. And when they say physical activity, they mean any movement you do for at least 10 minutes at a time, adding up to about 30 minutes or more a week. It's not just sport, so it could be walking or wheeling if you're in a chair, travelling by bike or on foot, gardening, playing with the family, having an active job, or even swimming outdoors. Okay, I'm not sure we've got many outdoor swimmers
wild
here.
Wild swimmers.
Wild swimmers, yes. So they've developed a very short survey which you can access online, so you'll need to be online a bit for this, and it'll help them to develop the strategy, and it takes less than 5 minutes to complete, and their answers and your answers will help them to plan things like local events and activities, and safer and more welcoming spaces for being active. And I say this actually because a number of our people also use the city's gyms and swimming pools and what have you, and we find sometimes that access arrangements for particularly for visually impaired people and for visually impaired people with guide dogs as well can be tricky at times. So it'd be really useful to have your input on that. So you've got a few weeks to do it. The survey closes on Sunday the 2nd of November. So if you want to complete it online yourself, you can do that by going to, well, I'm going to give you the whole thing, but you might not need to put this very first bit in, https://. But anyway, the website address is letstalk.coventry.gov.uk/cov-moves. So letstalk.coventry.gov.uk/cov-moves. If you really want to take part in that and you struggle to access internet things, when you're next in, just give one of us a call, or you can find one of us and we'll do it with you, or give us a call and we'll do it over the phone, and that's no problem at all.
And last week, The Wave was highly commended in Postbag.
Oh, was it?
For being Welcome Me.
Oh, right. That's very good.
Service.
That's good. That's really good to hear. We're going to be looking out for... We'll come back to you in the future, because we're looking out for more organisations and businesses that provide excellent service or have provided excellent service for people with visual impairments. But there'll be more about that in due course. And that, dear friends, is it for this week. Do get in contact with us if you need anything.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you.
We now move on. And from news at the Hub to news of sport with Sarah.
Well, hello there, lovely, lovely listeners, and welcome to sport. This week, the focus is actually mostly local sport. and I shall be covering football, rugby union, before briefly mentioning cricket and F1. So let's start with football and Coventry City. On Wednesday of last week, we headed up or down the M1 to Millwall. Now, Millwall, shall we say, have an iffy reputation for being rather over-friendly with the opposing fans. You know, one knuckle duster supplied with every ticket. Anyway, it wasn't that reason that I was slightly apprehensive about this match. It was because Millwall had beaten us 2-1 just a few weeks ago in the Carabao Cup. Oh, well, it couldn't happen 2 matches on the go, could it? Well, halfway through the first half, Hadji Wright scored and put us in the lead. Now, the rest of the half continued, but once the second half had started, Millwall came out of their blocks like Usain Bolt on heat. But to no avail, because Hadji Wright scored again. And then Ellis Sims poked home into the goal to make it City 3. That was in about the 75th minute. And very shortly after, a new name to the City scoring lineup, Kane Kessler-Hayden, made it 4-0. And then he has a celebratory sort of move after he scored. He does a double round-off backflip. OK, Kane, but just don't injure yourself doing that. So, I put it this way, it wasn't the City fans who I think would have to worry about the Millwall fans, but the Millwall team. Actually, most of the fans had left by the time of our third goal, and those that hadn't certainly left after we scored a fourth goal. So it's getting rather exciting because Coventry City were now second in the division, and most staggeringly, we've got an outstanding goal difference of 15, which is 7 ahead of anyone in the Championship. So, on Saturday, our lads had a quick turnaround and headed up whichever road takes you to Sheffield Wednesday. Actually, I'll just emphasise that quick turnaround because from the Millwall match, they got home in the early hours of Thursday, didn't play or train on Thursday, put in some training Friday morning, and then they were back in their coach to go up to Sheffield. I don't know, and you hear the Premiership babies complaining. Now, Sheffield Wednesday are in a real financial situation. This is the 6 month out of 7 that their players have not been paid on time. In fact, some of their other staff have had to take out bank loans to make ends meet. But it had been announced at about that on the 10th minute there would be a fans' pitch invasion. So there was a lot of worry about would the match be abandoned. Well, fortunately, the invasion was actually quite good-humoured and didn't feature a lot of their fans, and it only resulted in an extra 5 minutes being added on to the first half. But actually, Brandon Thomas Asante hadn't waited that long because on the 3rd minute, our captain, Matt Grimes, gifted in a superb corner kick to meet Brandon's head, City 1-0. And a bit later, BTA, as he's now called, scored again. This was following, shall we say, a bit more of a crowded situation. Oh, I should have mentioned that this was the same referee as had reffed our 7-1 victory over QPR. He must have thought, oh, not more of the same, I can't cope. Well, While we're still in the first half, Bobby Thomas headed the ball towards goal to be finished by Hadji Wright. It's a good job he did, because actually Bobby was offside at the time. Wow, 3-0 by half time. Well, to cut a long story short, Ellis Sims made it 4-0. And then it was lovely to see Tak Sakamoto back on our score sheet. 5-0 to City. Now, I really can't speak high enough of my City at the moment. First of all, this was the fourth clean sheet in succession that's been kept by our goalie. Secondly, it was their third match in 8 days. And thirdly, I think I've lost count there, I'm so excited, our goal difference is now plus 20. Well, at that point, we were top of the championship until Middlesbrough kicked off or finished their match. The rugby championship has resumed and the new season has started. Coventry are in the championship and their first match was away to Worcester Warriors. Worcester, who you may be saying, well, they're newcomers to our division, because that is where they've been placed by the RFU, because they were previously alongside Wasps, a Premiership town who went bust, but they've reformed and presumably met the financial constraints of the RFU and are now back in the championship and hoping to go up. Well, it didn't look very good for them, but it looked great for our Cov when I switched on at half time. But it looked good for our Cov, who were 19-7 up. And we nearly had another try immediately once the second half began. At that point, I switched back to the football chitter chatter. And when I switched over good and proper to the rugby, it was in the 71st minute and it was 19-all. But I'm afraid by the end of the match, Worcester had run in another try and scored a kick, and their final score was Worcester Warriors 29, Coventry 19. But things are looking good for our Cov. Good things are hopefully on the horizon. Now I'm going to mention cricket. Yes, hell have frozen over again. But this time them women is at it again. You know, the English women, the ones that won the Football Europe Cup and won the Rugby World Championship. Well, this time they're at the T20 World Cup. A different squad, I should say. Now, I know it's early doors, but things are looking good for England. Their first match was against South Africa. And they bowled South Africa all out for 69 runs. A total which they passed quite easily with 15 overs. And all of their wickets still intact. So come on, ye English women. Cool, this means I'll even have to watch cricket. F1 Grand Prix. This week, the circuit alighted in Singapore, which was apparently very hot, very humid. And I know it was run at night. And some of the corners on the track were 90 degrees. I've never fancied being an F1 driver, but certainly not in the dark, in the heat and in the humidity. But it was a great result for us Brit supporters, because leading from pole to flag was George Russell, So well done, George. And in second place was Max Verstappen, who was hotly pursued for actually about the last 10 laps by Lando Norris, who took third, having had, shall we say, a little coming together with his teammate, Oscar Piastri, and championship leader in the opening round, but Piastri was fourth. And also McLaren, who Piastri and Norris both drive for, took the team championship for the year for the engineering work. So well done to McLaren. And finally, I was sorry to keep you in suspenders. I was rather naughty, actually, after I'd finished talking about City. But as I referred to, the Middlesbrough match, which was away to Portsmouth, was kicking off after the City match had finished, Middlesbrough being at the top of the championship at that time. But I'm delighted to say that Portsmouth beat them 1-0 and City are top of the championship. Now, I know it's only early days and we need to be top come May, but things are really looking good, I have to say. You know, I mean, we've got obviously a great manager, a good, stable owner who puts his money where his mouth is, and a great squad of players. So City will be at the top for the next 2 weeks. Why 2 weeks, I hear you say? Well, it's now the international break. We have more friendlies and more World Cup qualifiers. And I know in our team, Hadji Wright has been selected for the US. So he'll be flying over. Please don't bring any injuries back this time, Hadji. But our next match is at home on Saturday, October the 18th at 3 p.m. against Blackburn Rovers. So, looking good for our City, and I'll end on that very high point. Have a delightful, wonderful week ahead. Bye!
It's good to hear the Sky Blues are doing so well, but of course May is a long way off. Let's hope they continue the same way. And now it's time to hear from Dave and what's in this week's postbag.
This is Postbag. Join in the discussion.
Hello there, or in my case, good morning. Because I'm about to have Marmite on my porridge. I normally have raspberries or grapes or something like that, but I'm having Marmite. Why? Because Wendy says some people have it. Well, Marmite is something you either love or you hate. But what does it taste like in porridge? Well, I just have a spoonful. Well, it's different. I think I prefer the honey on it, though. Okay, let's hear what Wendy's got to say.
Hello, my name's Wendy Pauling. I've just heard on the radio that someone has Marmite on their porridge. I was wondering if anybody else has this habit. I'm just having porridge, and I'm afraid I have golden syrup. I was also wondering about people's ideas about nice smells. I love the smell of coffee and bacon, and best of all, night-scented stock, which is a little plant which my husband has sown for me, so that when I go in and out of the door at night to feed the horses, I can smell it. It always reminds me of him. Bye for now.
Thank you, Wendy. I still get welcomed at the stroke support group that I used to take Sheila to. There was a speaker recently, a young girl known affectionately as Batgirl, and she said, if you want to attract bats to your garden, plant night-scented stocks. They are not the scary animals portrayed in horror films. They don't get in your hair, they don't drink blood like vampires, and you don't have to live in a creepy mansion either. They use features like rot holes, crevices, loose bark, etc. If you have space, plant a tree or two in your garden. Graham was complaining recently about the difficulty in obtaining a gardener. This week he corrects me on a phone number I gave out for Journey Care, provided by Robert Franklin.
Well, I'm using a mobile phone, actually, to see whether the frequency response of this phone matches the frequency response of the Resource Centre's telephone system, or the Hub's telephone system. It would be interesting to see whether it's any better. First of all, congratulations to Dave Monks for his Make a Difference award. Secondly, I'm just querying the number which was given for Journey Care. I noticed there was only 10 digits in it. Usually there are 11. Now, having said that, Sainsbury's grocery order number is only 10 digits, but it might be useful checking it out. The numbers what I've got are Virgin Care on 08 44 800 877, which is I don't know, it's about 13 pence a minute, I think, so I wouldn't ring that one if I was you. I've just got another number from the Directory Inquiries for West Coast Travel Assistance, which is 0800 197 1329. Okay. They're both 11-digit numbers, but the Directory Inquiries have got nothing else for which matches the number which was given on the magazine. So I just thought I'd query that anyway. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Graham, for correcting me. I missed out the two for some reason when I was typing it. Journey Care is on 0800 158 123. I'm sorry if my wrong phone number has caused you any problems. Thanks for persevering with the phone calls to Postbag, Graham. Your recording does sound a bit better to me. Robert Franklin, who gave out the phone number of Journey Care, used the service recently to help him on the train to Tynmouth and then back, where he went on a trip by train to Paignton as well, which was also helpful. And it was also helpful to Elizabeth when going to Tynmouth to her daughters and the Tynmouth Folk Festival earlier this year. Elizabeth went on a shorter journey recently to the church where she was christened 84 years ago and has never been back, apart from a brief glimpse from the road. Well, here she is to talk about it.
I decided to trace my roots. Being a war baby, bombs were all dropping on Coventry. They sent pregnant women away for their birth. And I was born in the little village of Ullathorpe in Leicestershire. I decided to go and check out my roots. And lo and behold, I went to the village which I was christened in. I was christened in St. Peter's Church, Claybrook Parva, which is just down the road from Ullathorpe, where I was indeed born. Whilst I was in this church looking around, I came across a long-lost cousin I didn't realise I had, a lovely lady, Ivy Hall. And she said, the Evanses are all in the graveyard. So she very kindly took me into the adjacent graveyard. And there I saw my cousin, Ken Evans, who was indeed her father. Now, Ken Evans, my cousin, he had a haulage business in Ullathorpe way back in the 1980s. And he is buried in St. Peter's Churchyard. I had a cousin, my cousin Michael, who's about a month older than me, sadly he passed away when he was only 8 years old. And he is buried in the churchyard alongside my uncle, my father's brother, my uncle Tom, who's my father's brother. His wife, my auntie Violet, is buried there too. A cousin who I played with as a child, Valerie Evans, she is buried there too. Indeed, there are seven graves all adjacent to one another, all with clear headstones marked Evans, which was indeed my maiden name. Anyway, the cottage which I was born in is Granary Cottage in Ullathorpe. The local pub, the Pig in Muck, in Claybrook Magna, is frequented by the local horse riding fraternity, i.e. there were five horses all saddled up, tethered, whilst the owners were all drinking beer. The Pig in Muck, incidentally, has got an extensive menu. It was full of diners at the time. Very enjoyable.
There was a double christening that day in the church. Her cousin Michael was also christened. Tragically, at the age of 8, he was killed by a school bus going to Elizabeth's cousin Ivy's birthday party, whom she met in the church. Thank you for that lovely report, Elizabeth, which I'm sure members of your family will find interesting in the years to come. Bob Syme has a history of owning 3 lovely guide dogs. He has become disillusioned and critical of guide dogs to the blind in recent times, but as Outlook looks on the positive side of life, I would like to say that having a guide dog can change the life of a visually impaired person. Here's Bob.
Hello, this is Bob Syme. I'd just like to talk about my experience with guide dogs. I've had guide dogs, 3 guide dogs altogether, Jackson, Elliot and Topper. That's over the last 27 years. I was asked to start the Coventry branch of guide dogs then, which I've done for the first 3 years. I was chairman, and we raised about £100,000, or just over £100,000 in them 3 years. I still kept helping them for several years later. And we were raising around the $32,000 to $34,000 each year, which was very good for guide dogs. But when I lost my last guide dog, Topper, I had Jackson, then Elliot was 12 and a half when he retired. He was checked several times. Then I had Elliot, I lost with cancer at 7 and a half, and I had Topper, though, through his German Shepherd. He was 8 stone. And he had a little lump come on his leg, no bigger than a pea. And I told guide dogs I'd have to get another guide dog. Took my name down for another guide dog as I'm having Topper checked and I've retired him. Unfortunately, that turned to cancer and I lost him on March the 13th last year. Nearly a year and 18 months ago. And so I'd like to pray for another dog. I never heard a thing from them at all. So I already notified the Kenilworth Dog Trust. I have no faith in guide dogs anymore, and I'll put my name down for a dog if you get a Labrador, a Lab Retriever, or a German Shepherd. 2 weeks later, they phoned me and told me they'd got the Labrador cross with a Pepper called Pepper, a Retriever, Lab Retriever cross. Absolutely wonderful dog. So I picked her up on the 30th of September last year, so I've had it just over a year now. She's not a guide dog, she's just my pet dog. I never heard a thing from guide dogs.
Well, I'm glad it worked out fine for you in the end, and you have a lovely dog, Bob. Bear in mind that the Dogs Trust, although they're a really good service, they don't provide or train guide dogs. Sheila did sponsor a guide dog puppy, but the lion's share of the fundraising was for the now Coventry Vision Hub, which of course is local and helps you. Thank you for your messages this week, and please let's hear from you next week. I'm sure we've got lots of things we can talk about. Have you ever been back to your roots, by the way? Tell us about it. Any interesting family history? And any helpful tips you've got, you can pass on to your fellow listeners, or holidays you've been on, anything like that, or comments arising from items on the news, for instance, or the Outlook magazine articles. Okay, thank you very much, and bye for now.
This is Outlook. You can contact Postbag.
Our website is www.talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Our email address is postbag@talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Join in the discussion on Postbag.
So that's your Postbag. Do let us hear from you. Now, from one Newbold to another. This time, Elaine's in Newbold-on-Stour.
The village of Newbold-on-Stour probably started as a cluster of cottages around a toll house and inn, both still standing. 6 miles south of Stratford-upon-Avon, on the road to Shipston-on-Stour and Oxford. It is still not much more. Most buildings are Georgian or Victorian or later. An exception is Ettington Park, which, despite its name, is at the northern end of Newbold. The Victorian house, recently restored after a fire, is a hotel, but it and the park are owned by the Shirley family, who are believed to be the only family left who can still claim to own the land they held at the time of the Norman conquest. Also on Shirley land, alongside the River Stour, is the headquarters of Newbold-on-Stour Sea Scout Troop, which is the Sea Scout Troop furthest from the sea. Founded in 1957 and still thriving, the troop is one of the select band of 100 holding Royal Navy recognition. The village made local news in 1912 with a devastating fire. A row of cottages with thatched roofs opposite the Victorian Parish Church caught fire, and sparks travelled about 100 yards to another row of thatched cottages, and they were all destroyed. A horse-drawn manual fire engine was taken down a track to the river, and hoses led to the fire, but without effect. Those cob-walled cottages have now been replaced with brick-walled, slate-roofed houses, mainly occupied by commuters. The only thatch building left in the village is known as the Bothy, probably 300 years old. It has thick cob walls and has recently been rethatched. It stands on the village green near the village hall, which was built to replace a wooden hut in the 1950s. The dividing line between the common and Shirley land passes through the foundations, as the Shirleys did not wish to part with any of their long-held land, rights had to be negotiated. The River Stour provides power for a large number of mills. All are now gone, or converted into residences, but the last to go was Talton Mill, where the Holburton family now farm and sell produce. A notable village craftsman was the saddler Mr. J. Rimmel, with a reputation that brought in work from a wide area. He had a regular standby contract to make large numbers of martingales to take horse brasses made in Birmingham and sold in America. He died in 1975, but a village road is named after him, and his apprentice continues the trade under his name in Shipston-on-Stour. At Armscote, on the south side of the village, there is a Quaker meeting house. It attracts Quakers from all over the country on the first Sunday in August each year, as it was one of the last stopping places of George Fox when he was hounded across the country. About 1910, Primitive Methodists held meetings in the kitchen of the end cottage of the row later burnt down. It is said that the preacher sat on the copper, and the congregation sat on forms. They built the Methodist church, which is bang up against the busy A3400 road. The church has recently been renovated and services are held there every Sunday. The Victorian Parish Church, St David's, is also still used regularly. The present priest in charge lives in neighbouring Treddington, while the old Newbold Rectory, known as the Grange, is a private house. In 1999, after some opposition from villagers, a large housing estate of 50 houses was built on the southern outskirts of Newbold, which has increased the population of the village by about 50%. The church school, which has been threatened with closure many times, has been amalgamated with Treddington School as one school on two sites. Newbold houses the younger children and has a flourishing nursery. The new housing estate has at least ensured the demand for a school in the village, and there is also a flourishing village shop, a post office, two pubs and a bowling green.
And next week, the last of the Newbolds, Newbold Pacey and Ashbourne. Do you know, I've always been fascinated by Egypt's pyramids. How on earth did they manage to manoeuvre those enormous blocks of stone and then assemble them? Well, I came across the answer in a magazine called How It Works a couple of weeks ago, and earlier recorded in two parts. The second part will be next week. Rising majestically to almost 140 metres above the Egyptian desert, the Great Pyramid of Khufu at Giza, the last remaining wonder of the ancient world, still stands tall in mysterious silence after more than 4,500 years. Over the centuries, its untold secrets have inspired curiosity, awe, and bewilderment in equal measure. As a testament to the skills of the ancient civilization, it has no equal. For years, the Great Pyramid has been at the centre of a long and fierce debate, and this has taken on a new dimension as the centuries have passed. Old theories have been challenged, and some widely accepted truths are now proven to be myths. For over 3,000 years, the Great Pyramid was the largest human-made structure in the world. But who exactly were the people who built it, toiling for years in the heat and the dust, day in and day out, to create a lasting legacy to the glory and magnificence of their pharaoh? Can we even be sure why it was built? Pyramids have become universally accepted as tombs of the pharaohs, as a final resting place for Pharaoh Khufu, a platform in the air from which he could launch his glorious ascent into the afterlife. The Great Pyramid seems to be no exception. But is there anything that calls this into question, and if so, what? Perhaps the biggest block in the whole debate is not why or who, but how. The scale of such a task by an ancient civilization with very basic tools is breathtaking. The enormity and complexity of the structure has fired the imagination of global experts, Egyptologists, scientists, engineers and architects alike, resulting in many different construction theories as they all strive to unravel the secrets of the most enigmatic structures ever built. Throughout the decades, thousands upon thousands of schoolchildren have grown up in the belief that the pyramids were built by slaves. In Hollywood epics, we watch as they are forced to drag enormous blocks of stone, their bodies undernourished, their backs lashed by the whips of vicious oversteers as they plead for water. It was a Greek, Herodotus, who first made mention of slave labour during his visit to Egypt in 450 BC. The thousands of labourers required for such a monument could never, in his eyes, be found through free will. Without any surviving records to tell the true story, it's a notion that has stuck right to recent times, fueled by the references to Hebrew slaves in the book of Exodus. The story of Moses leading the Israelites out of Egypt captured the public's imagination with the help of the golden age of cinema, but has little historical evidence. The work of modern Egyptologists such as Mark Leher and Zahi Hawass has turned these popular beliefs on their head and uncovered a much less dramatic, yet much more human face to the builders of the Great Pyramid. early archaeologists were just as intrigued and enthusiastic as their modern counterparts and established the bedrock for these for later discoveries. They were, on the most part, however, interested in the bigger picture, the awe-inspiring structures that stood before them, and the power and majesty of the dynastic pharaohs they represented. The mason and the labourer were of little significance and interest until the end of the Victorian era. But every construction site has its workers, and it's through their lives that the answers to tantalising questions can sometimes be revealed. The discovery of the workers' village at the site of Giza pyramids in the 2000s opened a window into the ordinary world of men and women as they worked to create something very extraordinary. General everyday items can tell 1,000 words, and from this discovery came a new picture. This didn't portray slaves beaten into submission by ruthless tyrants, but honest labourers and skilled craftsmen who were well nourished, worked hard, were paid for what they did, and treated with respect when they died. What has become clear is for such an undertaking, there had to be discipline and organisation on a vast scale, coordinating large cohorts of skilled craftsmen, labourers and support workers in one huge effort towards a single goal. Burial evidence shows a hierarchy of workers at the site, from temporary seasonal workers to skilled masons, administrators and supervisors, along with their families. There was a daily ration of bread and beer, as well as fish and prime cuts of meat. It's only logical that a well-disciplined workforce needs to be cared for, and an army of builders would definitely march on its stomach. There's also evidence of medical care and on-site doctors who provided aid for a wide list of ailments. These would have been vital in what would have been incredibly long, hard physical labour and all the dangers it would bring. Evidence of how the workers were organised has also come to light. Estimates as to the entire workforce vary from 10,000 to 20,000, far fewer than 100,000 estimated by Herodotus, plus another possible 20,000 temporary or part-time labourers on-site for 3 or 4 months at a time, all working for 10 to 20 years. But it's how these numbers were used and organised that made such a vast project achievable. Workers were broken down into groups of 2,000, then split again into skilled and unskilled, and so on until possibly as few as 20 workers would form a team or a gang with a specific task and their own team leader. They also tended to have particular identity. Pyramid graffiti at the third Giza pyramid proudly declares the Friends of Mekori and Drunkards of Mekori.
And more about the making of the pyramids next week. The RNLI, the Royal National Lifeboat Institute, has been doing some incredible jobs, often in the foulest weather, saving people's lives at sea. But one man, Henry Blogg, stands out for his exceptional bravery. And here's Elaine to tell you about the story taken from This England magazine.
Henry Blogg was a hero. Courageous and brave, but with a dash of modesty and humility. He called himself a crab fisherman, rather than the coxswain of the Cromer lifeboat, carrying out 387 rescues and saving 873 lives while doing a job done by volunteers. Born in Cromer on the 6th of February 1878, Henry Blogg lived his 78-year-long life in the same town. He seldom left it, save to go to the Royal National Lifeboat Institution's headquarters in London to receive commendations. Though he was born illegitimately, when his mother Ellen married John James Davis, who was coxswain of Cromer's second official lifeboat, the sea and lifeboats became his passion. He knew every mood of the tides and every weather pattern. Henry left school age 11 to join his stepfather and half-brothers, baiting cod lines, catching herring and mackerel, and hauling in crab and whelk pots. The family also ran a small business, hiring out up to 100 bathing machines, together with towels and bathing costumes, at a penny a time. Henry couldn't wait to turn 18 and become a member of the lifeboat crew. He had sailed the shallow waters in Longhorn boats and gone further out into the North Sea in Hoveler boats. He knew the treacherous shifting Haysborough sands, the Hammond Knoll and the Sheringham Shoal like the back of his hand. Cromer has two lifeboat stations. One is an inshore station from which boats are launched by tractor. It also has an offshore station at the end of the pier, where boats enter the sea via a slipway. This was built in 1923 at a cost of £30,000 to house Cromer's first motorised lifeboat. The sheer bravery and selflessness of those who try to rescue fellow sailors on the high sea is almost beyond comprehension. But to Henry Blogg, it was simply something that fisherfolk had to do, no matter what. After only 8 years, Henry Blogg was chosen to act as second coxswain. He was 26 years old. 7 years later, he was elected to the position of coxswain superintendent, a post he retained until 1947. He served with the RNLI for 53 years in all, and didn't retire until 10 years after the official retirement age. Henry Blogg's career was peppered with remarkable rescues thanks to his endurance in impossible situations. They ranged from freeing boats that had run aground on treacherous sandbanks, ships broken by ferocious cross-currents, men hauled from rigging in 60-mile-per-hour gales or plucked from raging seas. He searched 30 miles out to sea and dragged men from capsized boats on the shoreline. No matter when the maroons sounded and lit up the town of Cromer, Henry Blogg was always the first to respond. During the war, while dragging downed pilots from the water, that crew was made up entirely of elderly, non-conscripted men. At the end of his life in June 1954, not only did the whole town of Cromer honour him with a hero's farewell, but history marked him out as Britain's bravest ever lifeboatman. Well done, Henry Blogg.
So, Tom, does that bring back memories of Grace Darling, who, in just a rowing boat, saved 9 lives at sea in 1838? If I said disaster at 4,500 feet, would you think of a problem in the air, or maybe up a mountain, or even in deep-sea diving? Well, Pete will now explain all in this article he originally wrote in the Coventry Telegraph.
A police officer gave the most graphic eyewitness account of the moment that disaster struck in the skies over Coventry. The two planes flew straight into each other, PC Christopher Day told a hushed inquest. They seemed to lock together for a fraction of a second before there was a puff of black smoke, a flash of bright orange flame, and they began to break up. 14 people died in those few terrible seconds as a British European Airways Dakota and an RAF Anson collided almost head-on in bright sunshine. A final tragic radio message from the stricken airliner spoke of going down in flames. Blazing wreckage fell across 200 acres of farmland, the bulk of it narrowly missing the former Exall Lodge Hospital, then being used as an old people's home. Miraculously, nobody on the ground was hurt. The Exall air crash on the morning of Saturday, February 19, 1949, remains the worst civil aviation accident in Warwickshire history. And Kersley-based Constable Day was only one of hundreds of eyewitnesses. Others spoke of billowing clouds of smack smoke, a shower of debris glinting in the sunshine, and an aircraft fuselage twirling slowly down like a sycamore seed. Some saw four bodies falling from the sky, at least one wearing a parachute that had failed to open. For many, the scene of devastation on the ground recalled the recent wartime years. Wreckage in thousands of tiny pieces lay scattered over the field. Luggage and personal possessions were strewn everywhere. And poignantly, there were the bodies. Six passengers and four crew from the Dakota and the four-man crew of the Anson, two of whom were found covered with their parachutes. Dozens of local people rushed to help, but there was little they could do. And as firemen from Coventry tackled the burning wreckage, using soil to put out small fires, questions were already being asked. How could two large aircraft flying in uncrowded airspace at 4,500 feet in broad daylight come together so catastrophically? The BEA Dakota, piloted by Captain Sidney McDermott, was heading northwest on a regular service between Northolt, then London's main airport, and Glasgow. Among the six passengers were an Edinburgh chartered surveyor, a Danish businessman, and wealthy American holidaymakers Joseph and Belle Michaels from Chicago. The RAF Anson, on a training flight from its base in North Yorkshire, was flying east, with former Polish Air Ace pilot Kay Sawala at the controls. Neither aircraft made any attempt to avoid the collision. Evidence given at the inquest painted a grim picture of the aftermath. A wristwatch found on one of the bodies had stopped at 9:45 a.m., pinpointing the moment of impact. Identification of the passengers had to rely on incidentals, laundry marks on clothing, a charred wallet, a gold silk signet ring. And there was so little left of the two planes that their registration numbers could not be identified. Crash investigators failed to find the navigator's log from the Dakota, but in the official report, both pilots were blamed for failing to keep a proper lookout. The glare from the sun was cited as a contributory cause of the accident. 4 years later, the family of Joseph and Belle Michaels won £32,500 damages in the High Court. At that time, it was the highest settlement ever made in an air accident case.
And that's another of Pete's fascinating stories from early Coventry. And to finish this rather shorter programme this week, there's a little poem written by Roald Dahl entitled A Hand in the Bird, and it's read by Ashley.
I am a maiden who is 40, and a maiden I shall stay. There are some who call me haughty, but I care not what they say. I was running the tombola at our church bazaar today, and doing it with gusto in my usual jolly way, when suddenly, I knew not why, there came a funny feeling of something crawling up my thigh. I nearly hit the ceiling. A mouse, I thought, how foul, how mean, how exquisitely tickly. Quite soon, I know I'm going to scream, I've got to catch it quickly. I made a grab, I caught the mouse, now right inside my knickers. A mouse, my foot, it was a hand. Great Scott, it was the vicar's.
And that, I'm sorry to say, brings us to the end of this week's Outlook. So it's goodbye from me, Nigel Hewin, and all the team here, until next week.